So I've been doing some cable management recently.
All that earlier talk that we had about monitors, is that actually the pre-show or is that the pre-show? Or are you going to cut that whole thing? How are people going to learn anything about monitors, Daniel?
I don't know. We're just, they'll just have to wonder.
They'll just have to wonder. Oh boy.
Yeah.
The lost monitor segment.
Indeed.
Everyone's going to be clamoring for it.
Well, as I've been thinking about those monitors, I've been doing a bunch of cable management in my desk.
Sure.
Because my desk is a mess. I have multiple computers on it and all these things. And there's wires everywhere.
Are there any cameras on your desk?
Not usually. Well, the webcam. But I don't normally keep cameras on my desk.
Okay, they're on the bespoke camera shelf.
Obviously. Yeah. I mean, isn't that where you keep yours?
I try to keep mine where they're mostly on display.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's kind of my goal too. Anyway, as I was doing my cable management, I was messing with power strips and I realized that I made a decision in my life a while back.
Would you call it a critical error?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I made a decision in my life a while back that has really paid off and been super beneficial. And I'm curious if you've done this, but you know, when you use a power strip, a lot of times you have the big power bricks, you know, from whatever electronics. And sometimes the plug is at like a weird right angle or whatever. And, you know, basically a lot of times you can't plug in everything you want to plug into on the power strip.
Right.
Because you plug one thing in and you can't use the plug on either side. And mm-hmm. It's this whole mess.
Yeah. Real problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, you can buy those power strips that look like a squid or whatever, where they just have cables instead. Have you ever seen those? You know what I mean?
Sorry, wait, what?
You can buy a power strip where instead of just being like a strip of plugs, it just has like an octopus of cables.
Oh, what? Weird. Yeah. I didn't know. What, does it surge protect?
Yeah. It's the same as the normal thing.
But are they called
I think it's called a power squid. I think it's the same.
Something okay, like while you talk
no,
about
don't,
that.
No, don't look that up. Don't buy that.
Can I look at it? I mean, don't even look at a picture?
I guess you can look at it.
Power squid.
I think that's what it's called. I don't know. I've seen these things before.
There's a triple outlet thing. Anyway.
Oh, so I don't like that idea because for one thing, it looks kind of messy. And I also, I've got a lot of power strips. I have a UPS, you know, with a battery backup and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have this problem. And what I've discovered is that you can get on Amazon and you can buy little like 6-inch or 1-foot extension cords.
Yep.
And you can, and they're cheap too. I don't remember how much it is, but you can get them cheap. And it's a 3-prong, like heavy duty extension cords, like a foot long. And so what I did was I bought like 2 boxes of these things. I've got, you know, probably 20 of them and I just keep them in the closet. And I can't tell you how many times I find myself going to that closet to get one of those little extension things. I use them all the time.
Oh yeah. You told me about this previously, and as a result, I bought quite a few of those, 4 different like configurations. Like underneath my TV, where I have everything plugged into a single power strip, I have like 5 of those things in use because of the giant power bricks.
Yep,
that you're plugging in like a Nintendo Switch or a plug thing to control lights. It's just totally necessitated by like the way the power strips are configured.
And it's just one of those things where it's like, don't wait until you need it to buy that. Buy it, you know, just buy a box of them and just have them around. And you will be surprised how many times that comes in handy. I've even had a time where I was trying to plug something in and it just didn't quite reach the outlet. Like it was just a little bit too far away. And I mean, it was like, you know, a few inches away.
Uh-huh.
It's got one of those things, plug it in. Perfect. They're great. I think everyone should get those and we will put a link in the show notes.
So what have you sorted out with your cable management? I mean, like, yes, you got all these super sick, tiny extension cords that you plug in one after the other into a series of 15 6-inch extension cords. That's not an electrical hazard.
Yeah, don't do that.
Have you have a sit-stand desk? Mm-hmm. Have you mounted the power strip to the bottom of your desk yet?
I maybe I should. I don't really want to drill into the desk, and it just seems like it's so hard to find adhesive that actually holds up.
None of it holds up.
Yeah. So I still have that stuff on the floor. I've got a regular power strip and a UPS. And so I have all the things that I want to be battery backuped on the UPS. And then I have another one for just like smart home stuff and things like that.
I have plastic cable trays that I have taped underneath the bottom of my desk along the back.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have put screws into the bottom of my desk to mount the power strip. And then I've taken a piece of wood and have mounted that to the bottom of my desk to use as a little shelf.
Ooh.
And so I have the like the heavy power bricks that you would, you know, my dock has a power brick and like my monitor has a power brick for some reason. And so I put those on the shelf so that they can be under the desk, and then everything runs into the power strip. And so it's like the power strip is the one cable that comes off the desk to the wall. And then the desk itself is like fully configured to be lift, raise, and I'm not like lifting a bunch of cables. And
That's what sounds like a pretty clean setup.
Somehow it becomes unclean over time. I don't know why, but it's like you can do the most meticulous cable management, and then for some reason, 6 months later, it's a rat's nest.
Yep.
And you're like, I didn't change anything. I didn't add any devices. I didn't pull any cables out. Still, somehow, it becomes just a horrible mess.
I find myself wanting extension cables for things like USB in both A and C, you know, because sometimes I have things that I want to have on one side of the desk and I need to run them to the other side. A lot of stuff like that. And I always feel like I take on a cable management project, but then I realize I need some parts to finish it. And so I get on and I order those parts. And we live in a big city, so I can get Amazon deliveries like same day, next day, whatever. Yep. But it always ends up that I order that stuff, and then, you know, like by the time it arrives, I've moved on, and I don't have time to work on that project again for a while. And so I do set up the cable, but like I don't cable manage it the way I should.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that's how it kind of just deteriorates over time.
I think now's the time, Daniel. You needed to like really commit.
I think so.
And get some cable management going, and start screwing things into your desk.
That's my goal. I've got a complicated setup where I have my personal computer and my work computer both on my desk.
Yep.
And, you know, I want to be able to use all the peripherals with both machines.
And you just want to be able to swap computers and have everything work.
Yeah. And getting all that to work properly is just a real pain.
It's annoying for sure.
Yeah.
I got one more pre-show thing for you.
All right. What do you got?
I charged my laptop to like 97% on Friday or Thursday. And then since then, I downloaded a bunch of files and like used it for maybe 2 hours on Friday, and then I've been like since 10 a.m. working on my laptop, you know, intermittently. I'm at 44% right now.
Wow.
And it says I have 4 hours left and we're about to jump into this podcast, and I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a lot of lot of battery life.
Continuously impressed by the battery life on my Mac. Yeah. I just can't even sometimes.
I mean, if you're doing video editing, it's going to go down pretty quickly.
Yeah, I can only get like 3 or 4 hours of actual video editing done, especially if I add a noise reduction block, like a noise reduction node on Resolve.
Yeah.
It just starts rendering in the background, the fans turn on.
Yeah. But if you're just doing general internet browsing or whatever, it really can last a pretty long time.
My wife is wind hardening her plants right now. Her seedlings, so she's like, they've grown up a little bit, like big enough to be out of the ground and sprouted, but before she takes them outside, they need to like be hardened off. And so we have some like high volume like fans, you know, like little floor fans, but not like just box fans. These things are like for drying paint almost. And she has
where did you get those?
I bought them because the washer flooded the house or whatever.
Oh, okay.
And so we had to like dry a bunch of stuff, so I bought like two of those things. Anyways, so we just have them, and so she'll set it, and like those axial fans are just so loud, and so she'll put it into the other room and like turn it on, and it's like there's just droning fan noise for hours and hours and hours, because she'll just run it so that she can harden off her plants. And I was rendering some color grading, I did some like halation and grain and noise reduction on this music video project that we were doing. And so my computer was like rendering it out, and she's like, why do my fans sound weird? I was like, those aren't your fans. She's like, oh, I wasn't used to hearing your computer.
It is kind of funny how, I mean, most of the time the fan just does not spin on that computer. And it's funny how whenever you start doing something, you hear it spin up and you're like, oh man, I'm working now.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Camera Gear Podcast. I'm Daniel.
And I'm Lucas.
And we're here today to talk about the gear, software, and techniques we use to shoot photos and video.
I'm using my Cantigo water bottle today, not sponsored. And It is much quieter than my Nalgene, also not sponsored.
Stealth mode.
Like, normally I have to unscrew the top and have an air tag on it because I always lose my water. And so it's like, rattle, 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 glug, 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 rattle, rattle, rattle. But this one, you just, like, press the button and it opens up. Yeah.
Those Contigo water bottles, this really does sound sponsored. It's really not sponsored. I'm not even going to put a link to this in the show notes to prove that it's not sponsored.
You rebel.
But that is probably the best water bottle I've owned because it's insulated and it actually does seem like it keeps water really cold, you know, on a hot day.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a little button on top and you press that button when you want to drink. And if you don't press the button, it's completely waterproof. I mean, you can turn it upside down. The water doesn't leak out. It's a great bottle.
Yeah, but it also has a cap. So like the cap flips over. You flip the cap open, but then you can press the button to open it. And it's just like one button, drink with one hand.
Yep.
It's good. Auto seal technology. It also fits in my bike, which is why I have it here, because I biked here.
Yeah.
It just fits into my bike slot.
Yep. Yep. You know, I play board games every week. And
no, I didn't know.
The reason I own the Contigo bottle is because the guy who hosts the board game night is very particular about his board games because some of them are really rare. He imports board games from Japan. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a whole thing. And the one rule of board games is, you know, you cannot contaminate the board game. So you're definitely not going to have Cheetos at that table.
Nope.
And he gets really uncomfortable about open containers, you know, kind of like the police when you're driving. And and so he bought all of us in that group one of those Contigo bottles so that we can all have water at the table without it being a spillage risk on this precious cardboard.
Yep.
So that's why I got it. Great water bottle, though.
I mean, that's why I have one, too. I've partaked in the board game.
Indeed.
Anywho, what are we talking about here?
Well, this is Daniel's photo backup workflow.
Oh, yeah. So
which
this
does
is,
not exist.
This
so
is a
I don't know what
secret topic that I snuck in here. Well, because I know that you're working on these show notes earlier, and I was like, I'm going to add this one. He's not looking.
Yeah.
Okay. Earlier, like previously, you were digging through some old photos, and you're like, oh, now I'm trying to pull all these things or collect all this stuff. And then you had to export a bunch of photos out of Apple Photos.
Absolute mess.
Which
yes.
You don't, like, you use Apple Photos to back up the photos on your phone, but you're not using it as like your master photo library.
I'm not.
You're not importing photos from like your X-T30 or your X-T5 or your X-H2S or your Canon EOS R or your Panasonic GH5 or your Panasonic GH85.
I've owned a lot of cameras, haven't I? Wow.
Or your Nikon D80 you're not doing any of that. You haven't imported, you're not importing any photos into Apple Photos.
Yeah.
But
I've wondered if I should, which
this is why we're here, Daniel. I think that we've both realized out of this whole situation is that you don't really have a good photo library system.
No, I don't.
And I was wondering if that experience of waiting for, 7-8 hours to export 60 photos?
That's an exaggeration, but it took, I exported about 1,200 photos. And
oh, hot dang.
I'll just say it took longer than I would have thought that it should have taken.
I mean, I would think, you know, maybe 20 minutes at most.
Yeah, I don't know. It was probably an hour if I had to guess.
Wow.
Something like that. I mean, the thing is, though, it's fine. Like, how often do I need to do that? You know, I can wait. But the thing that prompted me to do it was I felt like these are some photos that I really want to save.
Right.
And, you know, I think they're backed up. Like, they're backed up in iCloud. Like, they're 100% they're backed up in iCloud.
Right. But you don't have a copy of those in your system somewhere. Right. Like, not on your Synology.
And obviously... obviously, that concerns me. That should concern anybody. Like, yeah, who knows what could happen to where those files get accidentally deleted. I lose access to my account, you know, that sort of thing. And it just made me feel like I want to be backing these up somewhere else. And so I exported them. I exported the unmodified originals of all those photos. And then I copied them to the Synology. And I also uploaded them to my Google Drive just so that I would have it.
Perfect.
Like two offsite backups and one local backup, which feels like a reasonable number of backups to me. But yeah, it did kind of make me feel like, you know, when I got the Synology, that was a huge improvement for me because it made it transparent for me to back up the video projects I'm working on. Because I can be working on a video project and everything just syncs in the background. I don't have to think about it. And that's been great because I don't have to remember to do it. And I feel like I need something like that with photos. But the one like wrinkle in that is I do feel like, compared to our video projects with the photos, I do feel like I want an offsite backup because, you know, they're more meaningful to me personally. Like a video project typically has been something that we're being contracted to do or, you know, or whatever. And I mean, I don't want to lose them, but if I did, it's not the end of the world. Like it's mostly I'm backing it up for like business continuity.
Sure.
But with photos, it's like, I want these to be around in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes me want an offsite backup. So I think I need a different solution for those.
So I know that you have like a NUC or some sort of like Intel tiny computer.
I do have a little computer.
That runs things. That cannot download your Mac photo, your Apple photo library, because it's not a Mac.
Right.
But if you did have something like a Mac Mini, you could in theory download that and push your photo library to the Synology just to have like a secondary backup.
Mm-hmm.
And you could also maybe like rsync that .app file or whatever it is. It is a .app file, right?
Yeah, it's some kind of...
No, it's not a .app. It's like some sort of bundle, whatever.
Yeah, it's like a package or something. Yeah, I don't know.
You could export that package to like rsync it to like a sync folder for Google Drive or Backblaze or whatever. Backblaze would probably be good. And then you could back it up that way. That way it's like you can still use your photo library.
Yeah.
But then you could set it up so that it's pushing to the Synology and pushing to an offsite backup by using like an ancillary computer. Or I mean, you could do it with your Mac too, but then that requires you to pull down your full photo library to your Mac, which would take up a lot of space.
I'd rather not do that because I need all that space on the Mac to work on projects. Like I find myself running out of space in a 2 terabyte machine with all of our videos.
Oh, yeah. So like whenever we have more than 3 projects in flight, it's like, well, so one of these needs to move to an external drive.
So I don't know. Maybe the solution is to get a cheap or used Mac Mini, which is funny because I had one and sold it.
Yep.
I guess things come full circle. But I don't know. I'm going to have to think about this more. My other solution would be to get a second Synology and put it at your house.
I mean, why not?
And have the Synology do an offsite thing. I mean, but that doesn't solve the problem of getting the photos onto the Synology. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough. I would never recommend that you do what I do, which is...
No, I'm not doing what you do. That's too much. That's too much.
Just link to it. I think like the life cycle of a photo is like when I take it on my phone, it uploads to Google Photos and it uploads to OneDrive. And then on my computer, I will like go through all the OneDrive stuff and then delete all the things I don't want and then drag them into Lightroom. And then Lightroom syncs, it uploads to Lightroom Cloud and then downloads on my server to Lightroom on my desktop, which is then backed up with Backblaze and uploaded to Google Photos just in case I add any photos that weren't on my phone. Like for my camera, I can dump them into Lightroom and then they'll follow the same workflow.
They're on
Backblaze, they're on Google Photos, and they're on Lightroom's Lightroom.
I don't want to have to do manual steps. I want to take pictures. And if I, you know, if I take them on my camera and need to import them somewhere, fine. But I don't want to have to be like, well, I imported them here and then I dragged them over here and then I moved them over there. I don't want to do all that.
You need some solution where you're taking the picture and it's ending up in an offsite backup and on your Synology.
Yes.
And then with the option of, I wish I could throw in some pictures in here like from my SD card if I wanted to.
Yeah.
I feel like making Apple Photos work for you in that way probably makes the most sense. You like shooting JPEG and you don't really edit your photos that much. Yeah. So it's like if you could find a way to have your full photo library download locally and then back up to Backblaze that library file, that's what it is. It's a dot library, isn't it?
Maybe so. Yeah.
I'm just gonna look here, Daniel. Why does it matter?
I do think that's the answer.
It does feel like it's a dot photos library.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I wonder if I can set it up to where it only syncs when I have a certain external drive connected. Like could I just get a T7 of reasonable size and store the photo library on that?
Yes.
And then...
I don't remember if it caches it, but you can, on your Mac, make your photo library be on an external drive. Yeah. I just think that it's like you can't open up photos.
That's fine. But I mean, like, I just wonder if I could, you know, to solve this problem, if I could just, when I plug my Mac in on my desk, have a drive connected to the dock or whatever, and then have it do all that, like, backup and sync stuff.
Yeah, like, you could set up an automator workflow so that whenever you plug your Mac into that dock, it'll connect the drive. It will then, like, in the background, download all the photos into that library, and then your computer can, like, sync it to the server. I think part of the problem is that there's no way to manually say, hey, Apple Photo Library, download all these files. Yeah. It just kind of like does its thing.
That's the problem.
And there's no way to know when it's doing its thing.
Yeah. I don't know. I think this is going to require more thought. But
and another Mac.
Yes.
You buy one of those headless Macs, like go onto eBay and buy one that's without the screen.
That's true. I mean, I've got a laptop sitting over there right now.
It's not doing anything.
It is in use, but it's a 2012 MacBook Pro.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud of myself for how long that computer has lasted. And maybe that's my solution. Maybe just use that.
I'm down with that. That feels like the perfect solution.
Yeah. I'm gonna think on this more, but I think mm-hmm. we're on to something here.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So I'll get there. I will get there.
All right. Talk to me a little bit about what happened yesterday.
I don't know how I can talk a little bit about what happened yesterday.
Daniel, this is
try and hold myself back.
You gotta hold yourself back.
Yeah.
Because we're gonna have a whole episode on this.
Yeah.
But it's not this week, it's next week. Just like give me a little bit what happened.
Yeah. Well, Blackmagic did another QVC event.
Yeah, they did.
Have you seen it? Have you watched?
I've watched portions of it.
Okay.
It's great.
So if anybody hasn't seen the way Blackmagic does their events, I'm gonna say this exact same pitch next episode, but that's fine. Just watch the first 30 seconds of it because that's going to tell you everything you need to know. Because the way they start these events is the best thing. I think this one actually did start with some sort of marketing-y type video. It was just like, you know, people dancing and stuff. And then I was driving when this event started. And so I looked down and I saw people dancing. And then I looked down a moment later and just saw the text that said DaVinci Resolve and then more people dancing. So I'm like, okay, it's that kind of video. The video finishes. And then it opens up on this, you know, set, basically, which is like a counter. I mean, it almost looks like a kitchen sort of situation. And the CEO of Blackmagic is standing behind this counter.
That's the CEO.
That's the CEO.
No wonder he was like, yeah, we like this. And I thought this and blah, blah. You speak with authority.
Once you know that that's the CEO, it all makes sense. But
oh my gosh,
he's standing behind this counter. And I mean, I'm not exaggerating. He's just like, all right, we've got, I don't even know if he said hello. He's just like, all right, we've got some products to talk about today. And then he just starts pulling stuff out and talking about it. And there's no like marketing fluff. There's no, you know, we're amazing. Blackmagic's amazing. He's just like, here are these products. Here's what they do. And I mean, I'm not being sarcastic. I love it. I think it's super genuine and feels like you're, you know, just in the room with him talking about all these cool products. And I love their events. It's like probably my favorite camera company to watch events from.
Then they announced so much stuff too. They're like, and here's this, and here's this, and here's, whoa, dude, like it's been 6 months, man, calm down.
There was a point, the video, the event and the video were almost 2 hours long. And there was a point like three quarters of the way through it when he was like, I know we've announced a bunch of stuff today, and I thought I might have to stop partway through to shave. Very, very good. Yeah, so we're not going to really go into it too much today.
That's it.
I mean, then, and you know, a moment after that, he's, you know, pulling out some rack mount broadcast gear and talking about it. It's amazing.
They just like right into it. That's awesome.
The things that we're most interested in, they did talk about Resolve 19. And they announced some new cameras that definitely have my attention. So I don't want to take up too much time with it, but man, it's impressive that they did all this in the last 6 months. Let's just say that.
I skimmed through some of the Resolve 19 stuff, and like the color features look really cool. Excited to talk about that. I kind of like two things here. One, obviously the highlight feature is F-Log 2 support.
Yeah, I saw that this morning because the beta 1 came out and then they said Fujifilm Log and Log 2 support. It's like, oh, Lucas is going to love this.
So obviously I've already updated to the beta.
I hope that's not true.
We have too many projects in flight. I'm like, no, Daniel, we have to finish these projects right now so I can upgrade to the beta.
Let me say this real quick. If anybody's listening to this and wants to update, what I've seen is that they have tried to maintain project library compatibility between 18.6.6 and 19. So if you have a project library with multiple projects in it, that should work across. But if you open an individual project in Resolve 19 beta, you will no longer be able to open it in 18.6.6.
That was what happened with 18.5 as well.
And it's understandable, but they recommend backing up both the library and each individual project before you update, which makes sense. But you know, if you're working on active projects and you're thinking about updating, just be aware that you won't be able to go back once you update a project. So
yeah.
I know for us, it's like we probably need to finish our ongoing projects. And, you know, if you're worried about like, you know, bugs in the new beta, which you should be, then just keep that in mind.
I'm worried about bugs in the current stable release.
Well, and I'm kind of hoping that maybe the beta is better. You know, maybe they fix some of that stuff.
Yeah, it's like we were kind of talking earlier. It seems like maybe they were pushing for like some of these changes, and it's like, oh, this maybe broke, or maybe they introduced a bug upon releasing a new feature. Mm-hmm. That's like, oh, this isn't going to really matter in a month.
Yeah,
and it just wasn't worth fixing.
Yeah, maybe so. Is there anything that specifically stands out in the update that you want to talk about?
I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on the fixed playback position.
Oh, yeah.
On the edit page. So similar to the cut page right now, the playhead stays right smack in the middle and you scroll the timeline. You don't move the playhead. Mm-hmm. When we edit in Final Cut, like the playhead follows your mouse. And I loved that because I could just scrub. I've took a minute for me to get used to having to grab the playhead to scrub in Resolve. I've grown accustomed to it. I do still feel like it's an extra step that slows me down a minuscule amount, not enough to matter. They think that, hey, this would be faster. Here's a fixed playhead position. The playhead's always in the same spot, fixed in the middle. What do you think? Are you going to use it?
I'm going to try it for sure. So for me, the biggest comparison is actually in Logic Pro, which is Apple's audio editing software. That one lets you pick. So there's a button where you can either have the playhead totally detached from, you know, from your window, or you can have the playhead in a fixed position. And I would say when I'm doing audio editing, most of the time I do have the playhead fixed because I can just hit play and I always know, you know, left side of the screen is what happened before, right side of the screen is what happened after. I don't like lose the playhead, you know, off screen, and I find it easier. So I'm curious if this can be the case for video. I'm glad to have the option. I could see myself using it some, but I don't know yet if I'm going to use it all the time.
Yeah, I'm probably going to give it a go too. I've gotten real used to how I currently edit, and so switching that playhead functionality, I do have found it annoying of if I want to zip in and out of the timeline, like it can get weird if it's always zooming in and out of the center, because then you have to scroll and then zoom.
Yeah.
But they're pitching this as like, this is going to make it easier to kind of like zoom in and out. I don't know if it's ever happened to you, but in Resolve for me, sometimes I'll have the playhead kind of like off to the left, like maybe 2/3 down the timeline. And I want to zoom in where my mouse is, which is like at the center of the timeline, but it always zooms to the playhead.
Yeah.
And so I'll like start zooming in and I'll come off center and I'll go, oh, shoot, mm-hmm. my playhead was in the wrong spot.
Yeah.
And then I either have to move the playhead or what, or like pan.
Yeah.
And whereas this, maybe it solves that issue.
Yeah, maybe so. I think it'd be cool to try.
Cool. The other thing real quick, how do you pronounce this new PYXIS camera?
There's been a lot of frustration online about it. I think anytime these companies announce that, people have to find something to complain about. And so far, the biggest complaint I've seen on the new camera is the name, which, you know, maybe it's
missing. Did they say it out loud on the thing?
I think he did, and I don't remember how he pronounced it.
Pyxis.
Yeah. I mean, so it's spelled PYXIS, and they have it in capitals, so you're probably supposed to shout it. But I mean, when I see it, I pronounce it Pyxis.
Pyxis, that, yeah, okay.
Because that, you know, Pix camera, you know, that kind of.
This makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but yeah. It's a weird name.
Mm-hmm. It's a weird name. So this, who knows if this was in development before? If they could develop this whole thing in 6 months, I would be shocked. Twitter is blowing up about this thing. It's a $3,000 box camera that's full frame 6K.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw this come out, the first thing I thought to myself was, has Daniel already bought it yet? Or is it not for sale yet? Because those are the only two options.
That's right. It comes out in June. Okay. Does that answer your question?
That answers my question. Has not bought it yet.
You're gonna have to work pretty hard over the next 2 months to talk me out of buying that camera.
All right, Daniel. So up here, a little farther up in our show notes, I have this running list here called Daniel's Case for Panasonic, which is all the reasons that you're going to buy an S1 H Mark II.
Yep.
Which, if that had came out last year as originally thought, I feel like you wouldn't be considering buying this new Blackmagic camera that we're not even going to talk about today. We're not even talking about it. We're not talking about it right now. We're just talking around it. And we'll talk about it next week. But lenses, which this one, this new Pyxis, I mean, like L mount, EF. Yep.
You can get it in L mount.
Yeah.
That's all. I don't think it's against the case for Panasonic because it's L mount.
Exactly. L mount. Let me tell you, sounding more and more better every day.
Yeah.
Box camera, LiDAR. So this one doesn't have autofocus, I expect.
It does have autofocus.
Shut up.
Now, it's probably not as good as, a true face detect, whatever, but it does have some form of autofocus.
You didn't even use autofocus. You don't care.
I honestly don't use it all that much.
Video features, obviously. SSD recording. Can this do that?
It can.
Does it have internal memory to record to?
Yes, it has dual CF Express slots.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that, yeah. And you love CF Express.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
your favorite thing now.
They even sell a side plate for it that has Velcro so that you can Velcro a T7 to it. Like, that's what they show in the marketing.
Are you for real?
Yeah. For real.
Oh,
it's wonderful.
That's so much fun. So, my question to you is, imagine a world where Lumix, because, I mean, it was this time last year. What if they announced a S1H Mark II box camera before June 1st?
Well, I think that's an interesting question as far as whether they'll do that. They certainly couldn't turn on a dime and do that, but I've wondered whether they would go ahead and announce a B-S1H Mark II when they announce the S1H Mark II.
I mean, who knows?
But, it seems like they could.
Let's assume that they don't. Let's assume that they just announce a standard mirrorless style S1H mm-hmm. Mark II, say at NAB.
Yep.
Or at like the in sometime before this PXS comes out, and it is, say, it's a stacked 6K sensor, same resolution, full frame, L mount, but it's stacked and it's got all the Panasonic goodness in it. It can shoot 120 frames per second, 6K open gate.
Which is wild, that's pretty aggressive,
wild, just insane specification. Who knows? I'm just making things up. This camera comes out. It's your dream camera. We've already established that. What would you do? What are you going to do, Daniel? What if it's also $3,000?
Oh, man. So first off, that sounds impossible.
Well,
but so if it happened.
I know for certain that would be our first two-hour episode.
Yes.
What would you do, Daniel?
It does put me in a tough spot. I agree with that. And I don't want to get too... So we're not talking about the Blackmagic camera.
If you're going to say not get too into the weeds, what is this shit?
You're a good point. The biggest factor, honestly, between the two, I mean, yeah, so there's form factor, you know, of like a handheld versus box camera thing. But the biggest thing, I think, is that all of these Blackmagic cameras, like this new Pixis, whatever it's pronounced, camera. We're going to have to figure out that pronunciation before the episode.
Pixis.
But the biggest problem is that camera primarily shoots in Blackmagic RAW, B-RAW. You can get it to produce H.264 proxies, which is neat. But, you know, your workflow for filming and editing footage is going to be, you film this in RAW, and then you've got to process that RAW, you know, and do whatever that process is, and then you can edit, you know. I mean, unless you use something like a Ninja, you know, to record externally. On the other hand, something like an S1H Mark II is almost certainly going to have good H.265, you know, that sort of codec. And for all the editing we've done, we've primarily just like our cameras can shoot ProRes, but we just shoot H.265 and go with that. And so
does this not include an H.265 encoder?
It does not.
So
you can do H.264 proxies or B-RAW.
You would need some pretty freaking huge CF Express cards or like a 4 terabyte SSD.
Yeah. Otherwise, you need to use the Ninja. So I think it's just kind of a camera for a different purpose. I mean, I think the B-RAW footage would probably look amazing. And I would expect with a camera like this, you would be able to get a really nice look from your footage. But I think that the workflow stuff would be more complicated than it is with something like our X-H2S. And I think the S1H Mark II is probably going to give you the option of a workflow that's closer to, you know, a normal mirrorless camera. And so that's probably the biggest factor. So all that to say, I'm not sure.
It's going to be a tough one.
Yeah.
It's going to be real tough.
Yep.
I was looking, I was looking a little bit at this one came out, and it's, like you said, shoots in B-RAW, and I know that B-RAW is basically 12-bit, And I was kind of starting to go down because I was looking at the super fancy camera. Like, we weren't even going to talk about that one either. The $15,000 camera
next,
that they made.
Next episode.
12-bit RAW. And I'm like, is it like 12-bit linear? It's obviously, if you're shooting on a large format video sensor, most of the times they're 16-bit. It's definitely a 16-bit sensor. Why isn't it 16-bit or linear RAW? And I'm like trying to figure out, are they just pulling 12-bit off that sensor, or are they doing like a 12-bit log so that it's smaller file sizes that you can then expand out into what essentially would be the same dynamic range as a 16-bit linear?
I don't know the answer to that.
I am going to find out, and we'll just probably talk about RAW a little bit in the next episode.
Yeah.
Just go ahead and make mention of that in these notes right here.
I mean, we know that RAW has certain advantages. The obvious one, you know, that you can choose your ISO and white balance and all that after shooting. I mean, it definitely gives you more latitude to adjust footage. So I think there's advantages to it. But the workflow is just more complicated.
Right. Yeah. Like literally speaking, if you have a 16-bit sensor, it can do, if you're shooting linear RAW, it can do 16 stops of dynamic range. Mm-hmm. Unless you're going to read the sensor twice and do some like weird stuff, or you're going to do like a log conversion and then you can stretch it a little bit. But I'm curious, you know, what that pipeline looks like for them.
Yeah.
And how I know that like Blackmagic's B-RAW is good. It looks good. Integrates well with DaVinci Resolve.
It does.
But I am kind of curious to maybe dive a little deeper on that, especially since these two cameras are going to be pretty hot.
Yep.
And a lot of people are going to want to buy them without thinking about the fact that they only shoot RAW.
Yeah.
And how are you dealing with RAW? What does that workflow look like?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's like out of the feature set, that's really the only thing that gives me pause. So
it would be really frustrating to say this camera solves everything for me and it's absolutely what I need, but I edit in Final Cut Pro or I edit in Premiere.
Yep.
And I don't have a way to ingest B-RAW.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the only option for a codec.
I think you'd have to use a Ninja.
Yeah. Which is like, I bought this sick camera that has dual CF Express cards. Why am I shooting on a Ninja?
I don't know.
Because like it'll do, I mean, I guess it seems to me that if you're not editing in Resolve, this isn't the camera for you.
That's probably true.
Because they have all of the stuff. Like if you're paying for the cloud, Blackmagic cloud thing, and it can do the whole proxies to the cloud, which just it'll shoot proxies and the video at the same time, and then you can just throw those MP4 proxies straight into the cloud, and then you're ready to go.
Yep. The other again, we're talking around this.
We're not talking about this today.
You can plug a iPhone or Android into the USB-C port on the camera, and it will upload the proxies to Blackmagic Cloud, like on set or whatever.
So
pretty cool.
So, like, if you're shooting with the Blackmagic app on your phone, I mean, that will just do it anyway.
Yeah. The
oh, you're talking about it will use the phone's internet connection to upload.
That's right.
Boo, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. That's super cool.
Yeah.
You know, it reminds me of this other topic that I have on here, which is the new S5 firmware, because they added camera to cloud support.
They did. Yeah, that was something that was interesting to see. And for you and me, that's particularly relevant because we do a lot of our filming is for a church, and that church has recently standardized on Lumix cameras. I think they currently have two, and they're going to be buying a third S5 Mark II. And we've kind of thought, you know, for some of these events that we edit, you know, now that Fuji's going to be supporting camera to cloud, that'd be kind of neat. But then, you know, there's people shooting on S5 IIs. So it's cool to see that they're adding that.
Yeah, it's the frame.io support, which is the camera to cloud. It is not like Blackmagic. There seems like there's a lot of different versions out there, and maybe there's some competition of standards, but this one is the frame.io version, which does integrate with things like Resolve.
Mm-hmm.
And the footage is just going to appear in your bin, which is super, super cool.
Yeah. And I'm still not, so do you know, does camera to cloud update, does that upload full res files or is it proxies?
It uploads proxies, I believe.
So it's I think you're right. And so I think the workflow is basically, you know, you've got people running around shooting. The proxies are going up to camera to cloud. And so you can pull those down and start editing. And then at some point later, you have to get the full res files. But, you know, maybe you've already been able to do your whole edit that way. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I guess it's worth maybe double checking. My understanding was that it's all basically always going to be the proxy. Like, it's going to limit you to 1080p just because of bandwidth. I don't know if you can do like full resolution.
I'm sure you need a paid frame.io subscription to effectively use this. Like, maybe you can do it without it, but like based on footage size, like you're probably going to need a paid subscription for this.
Well, you're going to run out of your 2 gigabit.
Yeah, exactly.
2 gigabytes of available storage instantly.
Yeah. I don't know. It kind of makes me want to pay for it for a month or two, or maybe for a month, and just try a project with it, because it seems really cool. Like, if you know, a lot of times, you know, if you're with a group, like let's say you're with a nonprofit or a church or whatever, you know, there's an event happening and people want to have like a social, like a 2 minute video for social media, like quick, you know, the next day, that night, whatever. And I feel like there's a lot of times when, you know, you may want to have multiple shooters going around an event filming, and then you want somebody to be in an office editing and like make that whole process as quick as possible so that you can just get it done. And that's kind of what this workflow seems like it's for.
I still really like the idea of getting people to just download the Blackmagic app on their phone and like, hey, use this app, click this button, sign into this account, and then just go shoot. And that's all you have to worry about. And the footage just shows up.
Yeah.
And then you can like cut it, edit, and throw it on Instagram super quick.
Yeah. Yeah. I still want to play with that too. And that's kind of what you're getting at, where it's like Frame.io has their thing, Blackmagic has their thing. Those aren't the same system. They're different systems. But I'd like to play with some of the stuff though. I think this is what I see as kind of the future of some of this stuff. It's clearly what Blackmagic sees, because a lot of what they talked about was in this realm. And then now we're seeing Panasonic releasing up to support for it. I think things are going in this direction.
Oh, for sure. Part of what Blackmagic was talking about in their event was like they were making the cut page so that you could cut things super, super, super quick. They're trying to make that optimized for speed. And they kind of had to like stop development because Apple came out with the new M1 Max. And so they had to optimize the system, like rewrite the code base for M1, M2, M3. And then now they can go back and start working on cut page. But their plan for cut was like, you're like live broadcasting an event, and then you can take the footage that you were shooting. You can take the camera to cloud footage that people shot with something else that isn't in your stream. And then to just have that be dumping into Resolve. And then you can like add in the cut, throw it into a replay without even exporting. You can just like replay off of this cut page.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's one really great example of, you know, we're doing this live, all this footage is just dumping into my NLE, and then I can throw it in live as like a, here's a highlight reel or something.
Yep.
But for what we do, if you were able to within Resolve have both frame.io camera to cloud and DaVinci Resolve's upload feature, and just be able to have volunteers shoot with their phones, and then maybe a few people shoot with the Lumixes and or Fuji, and it's like this footage is just dumping in, and the one person who's handling the social media stuff, they can just like see it come in, edit it real quick, and boom, send it out. Yeah. That would be great.
Yep. Yeah. I think it's really cool. And another thing to mention on this Panasonic update is that you don't need any new hardware for it.
Right.
So it just uses what's in the camera, which is awesome. And they also added some other stuff. So
you mentioned that you think that it only uploads the proxies, but Daniel, the S5 Mark II doesn't shoot internal proxies, does it?
Until now. Yeah, so they also added that. Now you can get proxies, which is, you know, also cool. But I mean, it looks like they've improved the autofocus. They mentioned improving the IBIS. I mean, it seems like a pretty major update.
Right. Beyond the camera to cloud and the internal proxies is kind of the big highlight feature. Great to see. And then everything else is like the autofocus is better. I don't know if they added animal detect or if they improved animal detect, but that was a highlight on the feature list.
Yeah.
And then, like, obviously, IBIS got a little better. There was some, like, whenever it initially released, a little bit of that canny, warpy corners on wide-angle lenses.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly gone now, so. Yeah.
Good to see.
Yeah, cool little firmware update. And I think it's live. So, unlike other camera companies, which may or may not remain nameless, they announced it, and then it's out.
Mm. Yeah, imagine that. Just being able to get firmware when you hear about it.
Wow. Weird.
Yeah.
Cool. Weird. Okay. Anyways, I have another thing on here, but Daniel, I'm going to push this also. There's been a lot of...
I mean, is this part of our main topic, though?
I guess it is kind of part of the main topic.
I kind of think it is.
All right, fine.
So, because, I mean, this is their biggest release.
Yeah. Yeah, fine.
Yeah, I think we call it part of that.
There have been a couple reviews that have started to come out on the Burano.
Yep.
The press versions have hit people. So there, some people got loaners, some people have purchased them. And there have been, I think, like the Geraldton Dunn one, and then there was what was that guy's name?
Robert Machado.
Yeah, Robert Machado, and he did one, and then also he did an interview with, I'm sorry, I can't remember anybody on YouTube, Brandon Washington, on his podcast, and he talked about using the Burano because they bought like five of them or something to use for actual production, and there's just been a lot of like lukewarm feelings about the Burano, which I find super, super interesting, because whenever that came out and it was announced, it seemed like it was going to be this amazing thing.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that was one of the most hyped releases that, you know, in a long time.
Mm-hmm. They added the whole built-in NDs, which was like an electronic ND instead of a bunch of, you know, it's one piece of glass comes down and then it dims it instead of doing multiple pieces of glass. But they combine that with IBIS, they included autofocus, and it's like you can't really get all the same codecs that you can out of the Venice, but it has all these really cool XOCN modes that you could get like 8K or this 8K down res to 6K, but still full width, and like all of
and
these
could
different
do all
things.
The stuff, and like is priced, you know, at $25,000, which was right. Kind of almost like a new segment, really. On
you get like directly in competition with like a V Raptor.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, wow, look what Sony's doing. This thing's going to be amazing. And looking at all of the feedback from people who are using it or bought one, it just feels like compromised in a bunch of weird ways.
And, you know, and maybe some of that is just because the expectations are so high. But, I mean, kind of run us through what were some of the things people talked about.
Oh, boy. I don't think I quite have everything here. But some of the things that I wrote down were the dynamic range isn't as stellar as you might think. I mean, it's this full frame sensor that's putting out, I don't think you can actually, you can't shoot raw, or can you? I can't remember. I don't think you can actually raw. It's basically all XOCN, which is like fake raw.
Mm-hmm.
It's like close to, but not really.
Yeah, I think we may have talked about that a little
bit.
Yeah,
like maybe go back and listen to the episode where we talked about the Burano, and we got into whatever XOCN is. It's a good codec, but they have, anyways, it's doing like at most 14 stops of dynamic range, but that's if you're like bringing it in and doing noise reduction. And depending on certain modes, like that dynamic range drops down to maybe 11 or 12 stops, which isn't really any better than like mirrorless camera territory.
Yeah, it's a little disappointing.
And yeah, because like if you're competing in the $25,000 or more price range for these cameras, a lot of the stuff that you're competing with is pushing 14 or 15 stops of dynamic range. Or even if you're like, I don't care about noise, what is like straight out the dynamic range? If you have a 16-bit sensor, it's 16 stops. Like you should have linear 16 stops of dynamic range as far as like your top end. And it's just not even close.
Well, and so you're getting at something that I want to come back to in a moment, which is the price. But, you know, kind of related to that, the sensor honestly just doesn't seem that great. I mean, the rolling shutter performance is really not very good. And it seems like, you know, a lot of the modes where, you know, if you do want to get better rolling shutter performance, you know, or if you want to shoot in 4K or whatever, it's like all the modes crop in weird ways.
Sure.
And it kind of gets to where, you know, sure, you can get down to something where you have better rolling shutter performance. Maybe you're shooting 4K or something. But then, like, you know, what are you at? Like a 2X crop? And, you know, what is that doing to your field of view? I mean, it just kind of feels like all of that stuff is very compromised. And those are things that I think we can kind of accept on a cheaper camera. But I just keep coming back to this thing's $25,000. Like, what, you know, why am I paying that much and then still having to deal with issues like this?
I'm not too worried about the cropping, really. I mean, even if you bought a RED camera, and I guess, you know, these shoot raw. So if you're shooting raw, like the crop is the crop because there is no oversampling. It's like you're going to get 1:1 pixel ratio. And so whatever the resolution is of your sensor, like you're just going to crop in to get 1:1. And it was kind of an innovative thing for the Burano in that you could get full width 6K off of an 8K sensor.
Mm-hmm.
Like they are doing things in the background in order to make that happen. But once you get into cinema camera world, crops are just the way things are, because you want just as much data off the sensor that you can get so that you have the most flexibility in post-processing. And that means don't oversample either pixel bin or mm-hmm. or just give me the one-to-one. And so that's why we're seeing crops. And it's like, I'm not too worried about that. I do think that it seems like the sensor doesn't seem that much better than some of like the current stock sensors yeah. that are out there. I think there's been a lot of comparisons, especially from Gerald, to the A1,
yeah.
which I was like, is that a fair comparison?
It sure seems like it, though. I mean, the A1 basically did better in most ways.
Right. It had better rolling shutter performance, and it was sharper at 8K, and it was sharper at like, you know, the 6K on this, like that oversampled XOCN 6K is softer than the 8K. And that was kind of like one of the big selling points of this is like you can shoot this 6K file that's going to be smaller, more manageable, but it's oversampled.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really that much better. It's not better than the 8K. And the 8K is not quite as detailed or sharp as like an A1. But the A1 has all of that processing in it. And so like kind of what we've seen is if you processed the Burano footage at 8K in the same way that you're going to that the A1 is processing its 8K internally that you can't turn off, you end up with almost the same image.
Yeah.
But the A1 is 2 years old and it costs $6,000.
Yeah.
Not $25,000.
Yeah. That's where his comparison was compelling to me. I mean,
that's the rub.
It's like you can argue that there are some things that the Burano, image wise, that the Burano does better, but it's like, is it six times better? I don't know.
Yeah. So it's like, why buy this? And the answer is it can do things like Genlock. You get XOCN. You get all of these extra features. Like, mm-hmm. you have a 12G and a 6G SDI output. You have HDMI yep. output. But there's certain things that start getting weird. Like you can't get certain display outputs over the SDI, but you can over the HDMI. And so in certain cases, you have to use the HDMI output yep. instead of the SDI output. But it's like, why do I have the SDI if I have to use the mm-hmm. HDMI? And then like they have this built-in viewfinder, but the viewfinder cable isn't quite long enough if you rig it out in a certain way. And so like you can't actually use the viewfinder for certain like rig configurations. Mm-hmm. And it just feels like weirdly compromised in all of those extra features too. It's like, yes, I need this thing so I can have time code and gen lock and SDI and all of these extra, you know, features, but they're all kind of like weird. Like for instance, and I'm just like rambling, you have to set the output for your video to match your monitor. And every time you change your recording format, it changes the output to the monitor format. And so every time it's like, oh, I'm going to switch from 8K to oversampled 6K. Okay, now I have to go back into the buried settings and find the monitor thing and then set that to, you know, 1080p or whatever my output is.
Hopefully that's it's just a firmware fix. But
well, Sony's really good at releasing firmware.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, right. What about the, but it's got built-in ND. That's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, it's got built-in ND, but what we're finding is that while the electronic ND is really cool and really good, it's like...
Is it really good?
Okay, so like, sorry. We talk about NDs and like, you know, it's filtering out the light. ND filters, unless you have a really good ND filter, don't filter out infrared. And so, or they may not fully filter out infrared light. And as a result, you can get magenta shifting in your darker parts of the image. And while the electronic ND gives you variable capability and can cut the light, it is not doing an effective job at cutting IR. And what we're seeing is that there is a decent amount of magenta shifting in the footage when you shoot with the ND. And so you're almost motivated to shoot with like a matte box mm-hmm. and actually like good ND glass rather than using this internal ND because it's going to start messing up your image.
Another weirdly compromised thing.
Yeah. Or like you need an IR filter to put in front of the lens before it goes through the ND.
It just, this feels so emblematic of how Sony has been, where I feel like you see these same sorts of issues on a lot of their cameras where they really push the limits of what the technology can do. And, you know, this is a super small camera, but it still has all these features. Or, you know, this is the first global sensor mirrorless camera, or, you know, whatever they do. And it's like those things are really cool. When you actually try and use the cameras or when you read, you know, when you watch a review or something, there's so many trade-offs that you have to make, and it feels like you really have to become an expert in the camera to even use it effectively, because there's so many weird little sharp edges of, you know, well, you can shoot in this mode, but when you do that, that's going to limit what you can do in this other thing. And, you know, sometimes you can't do HDMI out while you're recording in a certain mode, or you can do this, but it crops in a weird way. Like, it just feels like there's a lot of stuff like that where they're pushing so hard on the technology side. And it's like they're giving you everything you can possibly do with this set of hardware that they've created, but in a way that maybe makes their stuff a little bit harder to use. And, you know, it's hard as a consumer looking at those products, it's hard to not focus on the shortcomings when you see, you know, well, like you can normally do this thing, but when you go into this other mode, you can't do it anymore. And some of that just is a little frustrating.
Sony makes good stuff. It does feel like often there's a lack of polish of, you know, we stuck all these features in there. We know you want all these features, but maybe like the screen blacks out whenever you shoot 4K or whatever. There's different, all these different paper cuts that have come up over time where, you know, we will see them release a camera and it's like, wow, look at all this stuff that's in it. But, and it's like, well, they could probably fix that in firmware, or like maybe if they hadn't, like if they hadn't, maybe they had finished the feature.
Yeah.
Or if they hadn't released that feature, this maybe would be better. And so maybe the Burano kind of feels the same way, where it feels maybe a little less like polished, whereas they were trying to hit a feature set rather than having a fully, you know, like complete product.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's interesting in that, like the Venice 2, like I haven't dug enough into the Venice 2 and people complaining about it, but from what I understand, like that's a fairly uncompromised, very, very good camera. I mean, it's their top of the line cinema camera, but you would think that, you know, with the Burano being, you know, it's another island in Italy, right? It's like supposed to be a baby Venice. It just feels like it's maybe missing some of the pieces.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think that I've been imagining it as basically like a little baby cinema camera. And it seems, I guess I was just surprised when I saw these reviews that it feels a whole lot more like a super advanced mirrorless camera than a baby cinema camera to me.
Right. They were trying to marry the two. They were trying to say, let's give you what you like out of our mirrorless lines of our FX lines, but also give you what you like out of the Venice and try to combine the two. And it just doesn't seem like it totally worked. Like the autofocus isn't as good, for instance. And it seems like most people are saying or thinking an FX6 or an FX9, while maybe not as good, is probably, you know, the right choice for a lot of the applications where you would use a Burano and you're going to save a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's interesting. I think a lot of people have probably already gotten these because I know people were hyped about it and pre-ordered it and stuff. But I'm curious if it's going to end up being as transformative for the industry as I think we might have predicted when it was announced.
If I had to guess, I think that Sony is going to be doing a lot to address people's concerns. And I think a year from now, the Burano is going to be a much more compelling camera. I think it has a lot of the pieces are there. In the hardware is there in the camera to be good. It's just a matter of kind of finishing what they started.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, wait and see. I mean, but to lead into it, we're doing our camera series and today we're talking about Sony.
Yes, 1 hour into this episode.
58 minutes into the episode. I mean, Daniel, I have like 30 minutes on Sony.
Oh my gosh.
Like we should.
Do we do it? Or do we push it off? Do we make the people wait until next week to hear about Sony?
That would be horrible.
Be pretty brutal.
Because next week we have to talk about Blackmagic. Oh, and we're going to talk about Blackmagic for easily an hour.
Yeah.
I don't think we can do it, man. It's like, I mean, we're already, there goes my laptop. We're already at like 58 minutes, according to my watch here.
Yeah, this is a full, this has been a full episode.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about my photo backup workflow. And the Blackmagic event. I think we talked more about the Blackmagic event than we really intended to.
Crap. Oh, geez. I don't think we can do Sony justice.
I think you're right.
In 30 minutes.
I think you're right. Do you want to talk about, I know we had some other topics that, you know, we had kind of thought about pushing off. You want to talk about one of those maybe, and then we can plan on Sony either next week or
yeah, the after. Let's do that. Let's do a little bit of segment here, which is semi-Sony related, on the Sigma 50mm 1.2 that came out.
Okay.
I think that's interesting to talk about. And then let's go ahead and push Sony to next week, unfortunately.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Oh boy, everyone's going to be so mad. Yeah. Like, they don't even care about Sony. They don't love Sony at all.
We intended to do our Sony deep dive episode, and all we did was rant about how bad the Burano is.
Crud. That's exactly what happened. Dang it. I like Sony. I've always felt like, you know what? Everyone loves Sony. I want to get a Sony. I mean, you know, I could be a Sony guy. I could wear khaki shorts. I could do it. I could be a Sony guy. I could get a polo. But I just, and we're not talking about Sony. We're talking about Sony next week.
Yeah.
But it just, I don't know. It always feels weird to me. I mean, one of the things I'm going to eventually get into is like, they name all their codecs weird names. It's like, you're going to call it AVC HD, but like, is that really different than 1080p MPEG-2? Like, is it?
All right, save it for the show.
I don't get it. Like, anyways.
We'll get there.
I just, okay, anyways, save it.
Yep.
Let's talk about the Sigma thing. Sigma released a new lens. In L mount and E mount, as they tend to always do.
Yes.
No X mount version of this lens. What if they did that, Daniel? What if every time they released a full frame lens, they were like, we put an X mount on it also. We know it's huge, but like, whatever. You can put it on your Fuji camera.
I wouldn't complain. Like, maybe I'd buy it. You know, there some lenses I have, I really only use when we're shooting, you know, like a tripod shot or a big shoot or whatever. I don't care about the size. I mean, I have other lenses that are travel lenses, but that'd be pretty cool.
Like, for me, it's sometimes the full frame version, like while still huge, the full frame version of a lens presents interesting opportunities. Like the 35 to 150.
Yeah, you talk about that lens all the time.
F2 to F2.8. I mean, I have a 50 to 140.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. Like, let me slap that on my APS-C camera, and now it's replaced my equivalent 70-200, but it's faster. Come on. Just like remount it for X-mount. It'd be so cool. Anyways, they released a new 50mm 1.2, and it is for L-mount, obviously, and E-mount. And this is interesting in that up to this point, there wasn't really any competition for the G-Master 50mm 1.2.
Yeah, and isn't this the lightest 51.2 out, something like that.
It's definitely the lightest for Sony and for L mount.
Okay.
I don't think there was one for L mount before.
Okay.
I would expect that it's probably lighter than the Canon. And it's still like 1.6 pounds.
It's pretty heavy.
It's heavy, but it's like dense because the lens is only like 3.5 or 4 inches long, 4.5 inches long. Yeah. And it's a 72mm filter thread. So like, it's not huge. It's a compact lens. It's just dense.
Yeah, a lot of glass in there or something.
Yep. But what this quote from Sigma, they said that they like made all the lens pieces within the camera as thin as they possibly can in order to cut the weight. And so they had this really extra thin, extra light pieces of glass within it. And then they did dual linear motors.
Hmm.
And so with like floating elements. And so that it focuses very quickly.
Okay.
Because the lighter the glass is, the less, you know, less mass you have to move with these motors, the faster it can focus.
Yeah. Cool.
It seems like, unless we're talking about someone coming at you, like just coming at you, man. Like imagine a bear just coming right at you and you're trying to get that picture before it mauls you. You want that to be in focus, but the Sigma 150 maybe struggle a little bit, you know, when it's coming at you versus, you know, going left to right and that sort of thing coming in out of focus. So it's a little compromised in that way compared to the E-mount version on an E-mount camera. Optically speaking, it's just as good, as long as it's incredible.
That sounds like Sigma.
Like, we're talking, like, the chromatic aberration, you know, when shooting kind of a lot of contrasty subjects, basically nothing. It's very, very well controlled. The bokeh is all super, you know, circular. It's just like a really good lens. I mean, it's, if you're nitpicking, you'd be hard pressed to find things that this lens can't do compared to its counterparts.
Yeah. You know, when I first got into cameras, I definitely had a perception that buying first party glass was just always better. And it almost felt to me like, why even bother buying something that's not first party? But Sigma makes really good stuff.
Yeah, if I was in L-mount, I'd be buying so much Sigma stuff.
Yeah.
The if you're on Sony, it kind of comes down to what are you using, what do you need? I'm pretty sure that in order to have like focus breathing compensation, you have to use Sony lenses.
I think that's right.
And if you want to shoot more than 15 frames per second for photos with autofocus, you have to have a Sony lens.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some things where, because of the way that the camera and the lens talk to each other, like Panasonic was like this. If you want dual IS, you had to have a Panasonic lens and a Panasonic camera.
Yep.
So if you need those features, if you need the things that require the lens and the camera to intercommunicate as they operate, like, you have to go first party. But if you really only care about, you know, making sure that the metadata for the lens is correct and it has autofocus, then these Sigma third-party lenses are frequently as good or better than their first-party counterparts.
Yeah. And what's the price difference?
This thing is $1,400, and the Sony version, the G Master, is like $2,000 or $2,100, but right now it's on sale for like $1,900, okay, and I don't know if that's a permanent price drop.
So at least $500 cheaper.
Yeah, about $500 cheaper. I think that, you know, you might be comparing this to the Sony 1.4. It's like that, which is smaller and lighter, and that one's like $1,400 or $1,000 or $1,200, somewhere around there.
That's a much stronger comparison then.
Yeah, so it's basically the same price point, but it's kind of like the Sigma 1.2 is basically as good as the G Master. Why would you not go for the extra third stop of light at 1.2?
Yeah.
Especially if it's the same price.
It seems pretty compelling to me. Maybe that'll be one of my L-mount lenses that I buy when I
buy
Pixis camera.
I think you should get one of all the primes for L-mount.
Absolutely.
You need to get that 14 millimeter like ultra wide for L-mount. That would be super sick. Things like 1.4. Ugh.
Do they make that Tamron 35 to 150? Do they make that for L-mount?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah,
Tamron isn't a part of the L-mount alliance.
No, good point. That's a shame.
Yeah, I don't think Sigma has any like super fast zooms like that. I don't think they have any 2.0 zooms.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there was a rumor that Panasonic's going to release one of those 2.0 to 2.8.
Mm-hmm. I think we talked about that a couple.
Yeah, like
ago.
A 27 or 28 to 70 kind of thing. One of those like super fast utility zooms.
Yeah.
So like, those options will be out there for you, Daniel. That's fine.
That's good. This lens looks pretty good, though.
It looks pretty good. If you're worried about like how big is it, and like that's really, really important, you know, as I mentioned, it's 4.3 inches long. It's like 4.2 inches long if you get it on L mount.
There you go. Saving some size.
Yep, because the shorter flange distance.
Nice.
Yeah. Anyway, that's basically it. Without this being an audio medium, it's hard to kind of go into too many details on these new lenses.
Yeah.
But I think this is a really exciting kind of release for Sigma. Having a 1.250 and a 1.285 are, you know, kind of critical portrait lengths for a lot of people who are doing, you know, client work of let's shoot some portraits, let's get some nice load up the field, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so Sigma adding this in really helps kind of round out their lineup.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
I was actually a little surprised that they didn't have one before. I didn't realize that it was only 1.4. Yeah. Like they have almost every lens in 1.4, very few 1.2s.
Yeah. Well, it seems like that's just kind of the next area they're expanding out into. I mean, they just keep going, man. They're just constantly releasing those lenses.
Yeah. I mean, what else are they going to do? They're not getting anywhere with Foveon.
Yeah. Yeah.
They haven't released a camera in like 4 years.
I mean, I'm happy with them making lenses. That Sigma 18 to 50 I got for Fuji is like, yeah, I'm really happy with how small that lens is and seems like it's going to be great. I don't know if I've ever had a bad experience with one of their lenses, so I'm happy with them staying in that realm.
I just get annoyed at the plastic construction no aperture ring for their APS-C lenses. They're the 23, 30, 30 and 56 1.4 series of lenses that they make for basically every camera mount for APS-C. They're so good. They perform basically as good as the equivalent first party options, if not better, and they're way cheaper. They're so cheap. Like most of them are less than $550.
Yeah.
But it's like they don't feel super premium. They're not exciting to like hold or look at, which it's a lens, whatever. And they don't have aperture rings. They don't have any like buttons or switches on them. There's no autofocus switch. And I just want more things out of my lens. I want like more features out of it, which is why I strongly prefer the my 56 1.2 over the 56 1.4, even though I'm pretty sure the Fuji 56 1.4 is a worse lens. That thing at 1.2, I get so much color fringing.
Every time we shoot something on that lens, you're sending me all these cropped in screenshots. You're like, look how bad this is. Like, well, why do you keep using it?
Yep. It's like there's a subject or there's a thing and then it's on a white background or it is white and it has like a strong backlight behind it. And I'm like, Daniel, look, I zoomed into 800%. Look at how green the edge is. It's horrible.
Yeah.
But I can't stop doing it because it looks so good.
Yeah.
It looks so good.
And you're right. The user experience of using those Fuji native lenses is so nice. Like, you know, a lot of them are metal construction. They've got the aperture ring. I mean, it feels more at home on the camera than the third-party Sigma lenses, but I just can't get over the value. The value of those Sigma lenses is incredible.
Yeah, like they're super, super amazing, top tier, and just cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. Like Sigma makes good stuff.
Yeah.
They make really good stuff. I do wish that... one thing that makes me a little jealous about Sigma lenses is like that you can get basically everything in 1.4, and now they're releasing a lot of stuff in 1.2. You can get a 35mm 1.2. That's nuts. Like, that's just absolutely crazy. I think it's the only 35mm 1.2. And I'm over here on APS-C world where every bit of light matters. And there's like the 56 1.2, and that's it for first party. And then you got to go to third party to like Viltrox to get a 75 1.2.
Yep.
I'm like, where's all my 1.2s?
Yeah.
Come on. I know it's like a small camera system, but come on.
It would be nice to see. You know, Fuji's come out with, you know, how many different, you know, same variant of some of these lenses. And it's like, come on, guys. Yeah.
There's no market for it.
Yeah.
I mean, if Sigma's going to make it for L mount, because like there are no APS-C L mount cameras except for that one Leica camera.
Yeah.
And so until Panasonic releases a bunch of APS-C size cameras, which isn't going to happen, or, you know, like it's not going to be there. There's no motivation for them to make it because Sony doesn't sell enough A6700s and Fuji users don't want lenses that big.
Yeah, that's probably true, unfortunately.
Oh boy. I feel like this is the conversation we have every single time I talk about a new Sigma lens.
It really is.
And probably need to stop going down that road because I'm like, maybe I just need to switch to L mount.
Maybe so. Maybe we're both buying new L mount cameras this year.
That's going to be my future. I keep drooling over all of these L mount lenses and I'm like, man, I sure do like primes.
So tell me this before we go. What keeps you on Fuji versus going to L mount? Like, give me your top one or two reasons.
There isn't a camera for me in L mount right now. I think that the S5 Mark II is absolutely amazing. I think the XH2S is better.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for the only thing, in my opinion, that's like obviously like the video features, but I can get around that. The one thing that the S5 II that has for me over the XH2S is it's a larger sensor. And so you get a third stop more light. But other than that, it's like I'm getting a stack sensor with way faster readout. I can shoot. I get that 14-bit mode off of an OpenGate 6K. I can get 422. It's like those codecs are better.
Yeah.
And then when I think about a photo camera, I really like the film simulations on Fuji. I love the manual dials. I love the experience of shooting with my Fuji camera. Yeah.
And you're probably not going to get that on any L-mount camera that's not a Leica.
Basically, no. Yeah, it's just the experience of using it to take photos, which most... No, man, 70% of what I shoot is for me. And I'm like shooting pictures of my family and my friends and the trips that I take and landscapes. And sometimes I get like really good shots that I love and I'll print. I have a few prints in my house of things that I've shot, but I'm not really like selling my photos in that way. And so it's for me and for the experience of like reliving these memories. And I just enjoy shooting on my Fuji more, and also it's like a cost thing. You know, it's way cheaper and smaller. Yeah, so that's probably my main reason is like there isn't a camera for photo for L mount that is in my price range because Leicas are super, super expensive. And if there was, I would consider it more closely.
That's reasonable. I'm just curious.
Maybe that S1R, like if they came out with an S1 and S1 was like $3,500 or $3,000, call it $3,000 because S5 is already 2000. So it wouldn't be lower than that. Call it $3,000. And it was like 30 megapixels and it was, you know, fairly well rounded because usually the S1 is like a good middle point between photo and video, but it's the higher end stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like that might be pretty appealing.
Yeah.
But even then, that would still be kind of huge.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess we'll see what they come out with. But I think, you know, your answers didn't really surprise me. I figured film simulations would come up. You know, and I know you like the small size and the generally affordable lenses. And I don't think any of that's going to come to L mount. And I don't really see it happening.
Yeah. If I was doing more, I mean, we do a decent amount of like photo work for clients, but it would have to probably double for me to feel like I needed to get something that was more professional for photo.
I mean, I'll say for me, I think Fuji 100% meets all my needs for photo.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any reason to change that. More of where I'm interested in L mount is just on the video side.
Yeah.
And it's mostly because of the pro features.
Yeah.
I mean, the huge lens selection is a big benefit. But mostly it's about wanting a camera that has more pro video features.
For sure. Well, fortunately, your next camera comes in L mount and you can adapt it to EF mount.
Yeah.
So you can go get the Sigma 18 to 35 1.8.
Maybe I buy it back.
Yeah, buy it back. You know, you can use that with your EF on your Pixis camera and shoot in the crop mode. But then also you got all your L mount lenses.
Yep.
You can be over here on your 50 millimeter 1.2, which is rocking and rolling.
Yeah. The dream is almost here. That's it for the show today. Thanks for joining us. And if you liked it, tell a friend so they can check it out too. You can find out more about the show at www.cameragearpodcast.com. And you can find us on Twitter @CameraGearPod. We'll be back with more next week.